A little bit of the beginning of this message by Lillian Trasher, a great trailblazer of the Lord, has been lost, but you'll enjoy the majority of it now. Listen as one of God's great pioneers recounts the adventures in Christ she had while planting an orphanage along the banks of the Nile.
We had never closed the door on a child that we felt should be in the orphanage. I know there are many times where people, once the doctor rang a telephone from the government hospital, said, "Miss Lillian, a lady has just had a baby and died. And she died. Will you take the baby?" I said, "What kind of woman is she?" "Oh," he said, "she's rich. She'll pay you. She'll pay you well for it." I said, "I'm very sorry. I can't take the child." "But," he said, "won't you do anything for God?" I said, "That's the reason I'm not taking it. If she's rich and can pay me, she can pay somebody else to do it and leave my little corner free for somebody that hasn't anything." So we took only the poorest. And many times people just look at me and say, "Well, you're going to go to the war. You won't have anything. You won't have any food." I went through 2 wars and they never missed a meal. And sometimes the people couldn't believe it. They would, like Ernest Appleby was telling you about the time that the army, American ambassador helped us. The people were fighting each other to get to buy wheat or flour. And they'd have to keep them off with whips to keep them from crowding and stampeding almost for it. We got a whole train load, a whole car load, I don't know how many tons of the very best American flour when there wasn't any. Because the Lord sees all of our needs. And oh, how he has helped us in every little thing, how he's watched over us, how he's protected us from calamities. One night, just a few years ago, two or three years ago, my head men had gone up to Cairo for a few days. We had 12 very large buildings. And I was in my building, and at 1 o'clock in the night, maybe it's half past one, I heard the most awful screaming you could ever hear in your life. I jumped up out of bed, dizzy with sleep, and looked out of the window. My house was on fire. Our kitchen had gotten on fire. The flames were as high as the top of the ceiling. Our water works were not working that day. There was no water. Over the kitchen was a long dormitory with 44 little boys sleeping, little boys under 7 or 8 years old, right where the fire was blazing out of all the windows, up to the sky. Well, I couldn't move my legs hardly. It was from the shock I got. If I ever hear a scream now, I'll see that whole thing over again. I made a rush to the telephone, call the fire department, but we lived 2 or 3 miles out. I tried not to run because I knew I'd drop dead if I ran the way I felt. I went over. Now I want to tell you how the Lord sees all these things and prepares things. The water was not working. The pumps were not working. We have our engine. It wasn't in good condition. It wasn't working. So the women at night thought, "Well, look, we better prepare a lot of water and have it all ready for breakfast and to bathe the babies and the children with." So we have some great big iron barrels, about that big. In the evening, they prepared those barrels full of water to wash the children with, as we thought. But it was the Lord taking care of us. We had bought a lot of buckets from the American Army when they went home. I had hundreds of buckets stacked up in the storeroom. So one of my boys, when he saw the fire, he rushed to the storeroom, kicked the door open, grabbed the buckets, and all the big boys came rushing down. He threw them the buckets and told them where the water was. He rushed upstairs and he saved every one of those little boys, throwing the mattresses out the window. That was wonderful, but that wasn't the most wonderful part of it. The most wonderful part was this. Our kitchen was here. We had a long storeroom, about as long as the end of this, there's that door there. Excuse me for pointing like this. This room was a great, big, wide dormitory, but we were using it for storing things. We had kerosene tanks and tanks of kerosene in this room. We had soap up to the ceiling. There was a window just about this far from the kitchen window. The window was open in the storeroom where all that benzene and kerosene and air for the car and everything was packed. The window was packed with paper bags that we'd saved. some cement or something we'd bought. The window was open. The blazes were absolutely as high as the ceiling and passing this far from the window. And the window was open, and the smoke was all over it the next morning, but not one of those paper bags caught fire. There was another on the other side of the kitchen. It's built around like that, the kitchen in this corner. In this corner was a room filled with syrup. The syrup, instead of having proper corks to cork up these big native bottles, they had taken the sugar cane where after you squeeze it out, I don't know what you call it, what's left in the sugar cane after you squeeze all the juice out of it, and made covers for these bottles, or corks for the bottles. And then to keep the bottles from rolling, because they have a rather round bottom to them, they had stacked it all with sort of hay and all the leaves from the sugar cane. So that was just the nest for the most wonderful fire in the world. The window that was right over it was burned to a crisp. The window that's in that room, there wasn't a piece of that window left, and under it exactly was all this straw. Now, there wasn't one spark fell in that room. Not one spark fell in that room, and not one spark went into that bag of papers, and the window was open, and the blazes were three-story high, and not one child was hurt. The Lord looketh down and taketh care of his own. We had, a few years ago, you remember that we had a terrible time of cholera in Egypt. If you don't know what it is, I hope you'll never have to know what it is. It's the most terrible thing in the world. People, just the whole street die with it. And just a couple of hours or a few hours and you're dead with it. It's the most terrible thing in the world. It struck Egypt. Well, we were always taking in new children and all. We said, well, now we've got to be careful for the sake of the children. So we got busy and made a big fence around our place. Up until then, we hadn't had a proper wall all around. Big iron gates to keep the people out. And we made a very definite that we would not take a person in as long as the cholera was there, because that might just bring cholera to the children. So one morning, Sunday morning, coming out of church, there was a man standing at the door looking through the bars. And I said, what do you want? He says, I want to bring my little boys to the orphanage. Well, I said, look, you can come back with them after a while, but now we're not taking anybody in because of the cholera. He said, you know, I've walked 5 days to get here with these children. I looked at my head worker was with me, and he looked at me. We unlocked the gate and took the child in. The child had cholera. We took him in. We thought we were locking the gate. We took the boy in. He was a little boy. We put him in our nursery where we had, perhaps 40 babies. That night, the boy was ill. He vomited. Everything. I can't describe what happened to that child in the night. But the little fellow, he tried to run to the bathroom. He was all over the floor, from one end to the other, all through my nursery. We had a trained nurse there to help us. He had just soiled all of her clothes. I didn't know it was cholera, but I was a little bit worried, so I telephoned to our doctor. I said, Dr. William, would you see, we've got a case here that could be suspicious. I said, the child seems terribly ill, terribly ill. Well, he said, wait a half an hour and call me up again, see if he sees any worse. I called him up and I said, yes, I don't like his condition. He came out then. He didn't like his condition either. He said, you know, that could be cholera. So in about a half an hour, we had all the big doctors in town there. They took the child at once, and of course they took the test to find out what it was. And after another half an hour, they all came back again. He looked so serious. I said, don't tell me that's cholera. He says, yes, Miss Trasher, it is cholera. Well, you're going to be quarantined. Now, cholera, I don't know how in the world they get it so quick, but the streets are just wiped out. Maybe just the neighbors are just wiped right out, one house to the other. And that child hadn't left a face in our nursery with all my babies. Not one child took that. Not one child took the cholera. Just while I'm talking about cholera, I want to show you how the Lord works in mysterious ways, strange ways, unnatural ways. Just at that time, my sister Jenny, she's the only living relative I have, she is over in in California now, but she comes quite often to Egypt to see me because I can't come back and forth. I haven't been back in 25 years. I just arrived on just 3 days before Christmas from Egypt. And my sister was going to come over and see me. So she sold out a little house she had in Long Beach and came up to New York. When she got there, they said, but she can't go to Egypt. Well, Egypt's a coral. You can't go to Egypt at all. They wouldn't even let her on the first boat. So she cabled me. Said, what shall I do? Shall I come or shall I not? Well, I don't know what she should do. How do I know what the Lord's going to do with her? How do I know if I'm going to tell my sister to come and I lose the only sister I got? How do I know if God wants her to come and will protect her? And I tell her not to go. Come, and she goes back home. She's sold her place. She's rented her house. She's spent a lot of money getting all of her things over to New York. So I was just as blank as this board is. I didn't know what to do. So I have a girl in Cairo who's married. She just had a little baby. So I said to one of my boys, I said, well, take me to town, and we'll send the two telegrams. He said, what you going to tell her, Mama? They all call me Mama. I said, honey, for the life of me, I don't know what I'm going to tell her. I have no readings from the Lord at all. So we got down from the telegraph office, and I still was as blank as anything. I had no idea what God wanted me to do. So I said, well, you go send the telegram of congratulation about the baby, and I'll pray. Now, I have a habit of praying. I like to have my Bible. I feel it's a kind of a contact between me and the Lord. I feel it's the Lord's word. And it somehow or other helps you. It's like when you're sick to hold somebody's hand, when you're frightened to hold somebody's hand. Well, I feel like the Bible sort of connects you with the Lord. So I said, oh, if I only had my Bible now, I could pray. If I could put my hands on my Bible, I could pray. I didn't have any Bible. I only had a Reader's Digest. Well, I said, that don't help much. And then I thought a bright idea. I said, I know what I'll do. I'll look through the Reader's Digest. Perhaps I'll find the word God. If I can find the word God, I'll put my fingers on it. And I'll pray just with my fingers on the name of God and ask him to help me, tell me what to do for my sister. I just opened the Reader's Digest like I opened the Bible. And you know what I found? And I will take care of her. She shall be in my hands. This is the Reader's Digest. And I should take care of her. She should be in my hands. I said, what's the name of this piece? The name of this piece was The Unexpected Answer. I guess you know what I telegraphed my sister. And I sent her an airmail letter and told her to buy the Reader's Digest. Now, you know, that's what I like. It's just a sort of a friendliness between one and God, isn't it? He knew how I just kind of liked to have something tangible. So he gave me something tangible. Reminds me of a sweet little story I read just lately. As a truth, they say. There was a man, his name was Jim. Jim used to like every day, for some unearthly reason nobody could understand, at 12 o'clock, he'd go to a church like this, walk in and walk out. People began to watch him. He said, I think that man is going in planning on stealing something from the church, but the church people like to leave the church open so the people could go in and pray if they felt like it. But Jim never did go up and pray. He just did watch him from outside. He'd just walk up to the altar and walk right out again. So this went on for a long time, and finally somebody said to him, Jim, why do you do that? Why do you go in that church and go right out? You can't be going in to pray. Don't pray. Just go right in and go out. Well, he said, you see, it's like this. I'm a very hard-working man, and I haven't got but just a few minutes. It takes me just that long to get down here and get back and get my lunch. So he says, I just go in there every day, and I said, Jesus, here's Jim. And I go out again. Jim was struck by an automobile and went to the hospital. And Jim told all the people in the ward with him, he said, you know, every day at 12 o'clock, Jesus comes and sits on this chair and he says, Jim, this is Jesus. And everybody in the ward felt that Jesus was sitting there at 12 o'clock every day. Now, you know, that's the kind of God I've got. I've got a God that I believe that loves us, that pays attention to us, that helps us. And I've been very tired, and I pray to God, Lord, help me to be able to do this job I'm having to do, travel and speak 5 minutes after you get in the town and do these things. And God has helped me, and he's helped me through all these nights with sick babies. I must tell you a little bit about my orphanage. I forgot about that. I have about 8 acres of land. We have about 12 large buildings. Building for the girls, building for the boys, a hospital for the sick children. Last year I had 35 babies with measles and another 35 older children, but I took care of all of those 35 babies in my own house. And I have then my nursery. I have babies. I have 102 babies. From those, there are 36 that can't walk. Those live in my house. They're what you call mama's babies. And then when they get where they walk a little bit too much and try to run the house for us, why, we build a little place just across there, and those are toddlers. We have the rest of the 102 living in the other building. Then we have another nursery for those just older than that. We have very good schools, and we have a lovely big church. It don't look so grand as this, but it's about as big. It's about, probably it's about as long as from here back, but it's wider because it wouldn't have those alcoves on the side. Anyhow, it holds a lovely lot of children. And we have, I have an American lady and her husband with me, Mrs. Philip Crouch. They came out about 5 years ago. And they're helping me in sort of taking charge of the religious part now while I'm away, and the American correspondent. And I have one of my little boys. I raised him from 7 years old, and his wife, I raised her from 6 months old. He's my head man in everything. And he's in charge while I'm away, too. Then we have cows. I have about 30 cows for the milk. Some of them are not milking, some are. We have our own electric light plant, our own water engine and plant. And we have, of course, the bedroom. And we have, now many people say, how many workers have you got? Well, it's very difficult to tell because they all work. I mean, for instance, one girl, she bought the milk for the baby. One girl, that's her job, to prepare all the bottles. And so it's not get them mixed up, because some are newborn babies, some are 3 months old, some 5 months old. We have little colored tags, little sort of like tiddlywinks, with a wire through it, and we drop it over the neck of the bottle. And all the young infants have a certain size bottle, a newborn baby. And then we have, every girl has 4 little babies to take care of. But she doesn't have to do their washing, nor sit up with them at night, nor do any of the sewing for them, nor preparing the food. All she's got to do is play with them and keep them nice and clean and give them the milk at proper times and take care of them, see if they're all right. At night, we have 6 girls sit up all night long. They don't go to sleep at all, just watching those infants, keep them covered, keep them dry, keep them well cared for. And as they get older, why, then a girl could have 4 or 5 or 6 children. And then as they get bigger, why, of course, we have larger amount of children in each division. Some of the children do the sewing, some the cutting, and all the work is divided in the teaching. Now, I do an awful lot of teaching. I teach sometimes 3 or 4 hours a day. I get up early in the morning, 6:30. I start my English classes. I give them about 2 hours in the morning before their regular school begins, because the Egyptians are not very anxious now to teach them Arabic, English, because they haven't been too friendly with the English people, so they thought, why bother so much about the English? But I'm very anxious for the girls to know English. It helps them if the boys are going to become interpreters and so on. And our girls stay in the orphanage until they are married, and our boys generally marry the girls. Our boys, we have in our school up to about the beginning of second year high school. And then if the boys, excuse me for stooping over a bit because I'm a little bit tired. The boys, if they are intelligent, they show any intelligence, why, I send them to high schools outside. We have some little boys that came to me as babies. I have one little boy, he didn't know his ABCs. He graduated, went through higher training college. He's now a professor in Alexandria in the teacher's college. And he teaches mathematics. He's written a book on mathematics. Have another little boy whose father was a blind man. I raised him and his brother. He now is the head of a very large school in Sudan, a wonderful school. He spends probably about 3 times as much as I do running that work down there that he started. I'm talking about money. When I started my 35 cents, We've spent now, since then, over $1.25 million from my 35 cents. It takes me just about $60,000 a year. We get a little bit more money from America than we do from Egypt. People all over help me. Oh, and there is something too that's rather interesting, which I think you'd be pleased to hear. I tried for a long time to get permission from the Egyptian government to allow us to have packages sent in, but I haven't been able to do it. And sometimes I'd get maybe four packages, and they'd ask me $100 for four packages like that. Well, maybe I didn't have $100. Maybe I don't know what's in them. So one day we did get four packages, for which they asked me about $98. So I said, well, look, I'd like to open one of these packages and see what's in them. I think I paid about $30 or something for that package some time ago. I can't remember exactly. It's something like $30. I opened the package. It was a package of secondhand high-heel lady shoes, which none of our children can use. So, I mean, the thing is that it was just hopeless for me to try to pay the duty and get the package when I didn't know what was in it. So I worked and worked and worked and worked and never could get it through. But when I got ready to come to America, I said, now, Lord, surely you'll have to help now, because I said, that would be ridiculous to have to tell my people that want to help me and can help me to get blankets and things like that for the children, not to be able to. I said, I have to tell you, please don't send me anything. I mean, that was terrible. So I went to all the government officials, and everybody was pleased to do it, but everybody was frightened to death to do it, because they'd be accused of paying too much attention to the Christians. Of course, we're in a Mohammedan country. So everybody's a bit afraid to do anything. Well, just before I sailed, about 1 month, the American government made a contract with the Egyptian government that institutions that are recognized in America, like our churches, and institutions which are recognized in Egypt, which my institution is, and its number is number 52 in there with the license for the running of it and all, could have free duty for food and things for charitable purposes. So I went down and got that through in my name, too, not just open for anybody. I mean, I want to be sure they wouldn't make some kick and say you don't come under that. So I think 3 days before I sailed, I got my official paper that now we can have anything you want, only on one condition. You would not be able to send it to Egypt. You'd have to send it to New York, to our headquarters, because that's the recognized person in Egypt, see? So we can send packages to our head office of the Assemblies of God in Brooklyn. I will give the brother the address if anybody did want to send anything. In Brooklyn, New York, Mr. McGlaston has an office where he's promised to ship everything to us. And something else that's going to please you very much. You know they're having a lot of this surplus food being sent out. Well, they're going to send me now powdered milk, cheese, butter, and oil, and we're hoping for the first shipment to go out this year. And last night when I was in Jacksonville, I was telling them about the children needing blankets, because really we haven't got one blanket. Our blankets are worn out. We're using quilts, but they're not quite warm enough. So there was quite a nice spirit among the people. There were 51 blankets promised to be sent. They were going to get us new army blankets, which they thought they could get cheap. Well, the Lord meets the needs. Now, another thing about my orphanage is that if I don't take these children, they will never get any education at all. That little boy that I told you is a professor in mathematics. He has an older brother that didn't come to my office. He didn't know how to read and write until after his brother was through college. I said, for goodness sake, why don't you teach your brother to write? So he got busy and taught him so he could just write. So you see what it means if I say yes or if I say no. If I say no to a child, it's just not going to be anything but just a little ignorant child grown up. But if you say yes, I have boys that are preachers, boys that are teachers, boys that are in offices, boys working all over the country. I walk down the street sometimes, somebody said, hello, Mama. I look. Well, I said, who are you? He said, don't you know me? Well, I'm so-and-so. My, how you've changed. I couldn't believe it. And you know, it's rather wonderful. You don't know how happy I've been. I know I left America, and America's a pretty wonderful place. It's a pretty wonderful place. But oh, to be able to be in the will of God, to be able to change the lives of children that would never be any good for anything, only just to dig in the field. And to feel that if you hadn't done it, it isn't going to get done. Now, orphans here, if they don't go in one orphanage, they go in another. If they don't go there, there's just hundreds of people wanting to adopt them, just waiting to adopt them. But in Egypt, it's not that way. These are poor children. They're poor, very poor. They're hardly ever, any of them, practically none of the children ever come to me with another dress. They come with what they've got on. They haven't got another dress. They're poor. They're dirty. Why are they dirty? Dirty people? I wonder how clean we'd be if we had to live in a house maybe made of corn stalks and plastered with mud, and the chickens and animals in there with you, because these are the very poor people, the ones we take. Now, mind you, they are some beautiful Egyptians. They're lovely people. They're kind. They dress just as nice as you do and just as sweet as you are. But the thing swamps you. There are millions of those poor people. Millions of the poor people. It's too much. You can't do it. I mean, you can't blame the rich people, because it just wouldn't go anywhere if they tried to do it wholesale. They can't. It's a hopeless thing. I once heard of a soldier saying, when I first went to one of these countries, I don't know whether it was Japan or somewhere where the people were starving nearly, he said, I just felt I couldn't eat anything. But he said, after a while, I just got so used to it, I'd walk down the street, find people just dying on the street with hunger, and I'd munch a piece of chocolate, wouldn't even think of giving it to them, because it wouldn't do any good. It couldn't be enough. Well, the only way you can do in Egypt that I can see is to try to start in one little corner and just do that well. It's like planting your... I can't plant 100 acres, but maybe I could plant a half an acre. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to plant that. And you'd be surprised at the second generation what they're like. The second generation have a mother's care and a father's care. They live in their own little homes. They know the value of cleanliness. They know the value of education. They know what it means to be decent Christian homes. And they are decent Christian children. And God has blessed them. We've had wonderful revivals. And they're easy to manage. People say, how do you manage all those children? I don't have any trouble managing them at all. The babies mind me. They come in the room, and I'm very busy writing letters. Mama, hello, Mama. Now, come, darling, give Mama a kiss. Bye-bye, sweetie. And bye-bye means to get out, but I don't say that. I just say bye-bye, and she knows that means to go. So they just wave me back bye-bye and mind you. In our church, our children don't get up and run around the church. Our children sit there until the service is over, and if the little baby has to go out or something. Our children are well-behaved, but it's just because they're well-loved, and they're treated like human beings. They know I expect obedience, and I get obedience. It isn't because they're afraid of me, but they don't want to hurt my feelings. They wouldn't want... Well, don't tell Mama if they do something. Anyhow, the Lord has blessed me in my work, has met my needs. He's helped me, and I don't regret. But I thrill at the idea of 44 years for God. When I was a little girl, we used to sing an old song, when my life's work is ended and I cross the swelling tide. One day on the train, after I had decided to come back to America for this little trip, of course I'm going back, God willing, in the summer, I was singing softly, when my life's work is ended. And then I thought, well, I may go on working, but after all, the job is ended. The orphanage is made. The children have grown up. The children I took are grandparents. And God has helped me to have a block of 44 years, full work from morning till night. From night till morning. Many a night I spent half the night, or more than half the night, with sick babies, writing hundreds of letters, seeing visitors till I feel if another visitor comes, I just can't stand it. But the Lord has always helped me to do it, and I don't regret it. It's been a wonderful... You know, we've all got to work, haven't we? And we've all got to live a certain length of time. We just as well use it in something that's worthwhile, don't you think? Isn't it a shame that more of us don't spend our energy and our time and our days in something that really is worthwhile? Now, what is the most worthwhile thing in life? You know, you can't take money with you. And sometimes even you lose your health. And you couldn't do anything about that anyhow if God didn't heal you. But you can help a child. You can change your whole life by taking a child into the orphanage or into your home here, or working with a child in Sunday school, or teaching them a way to go, Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old enough to part therefrom. I'm going around now, practically most of America and all the different states around. I hope you'll pray for me, because I am tired. I'm 67 years old now. And I think folks generally retire about that time, but my work is harder now than it ever was. My children are more, my work is more known. And I'm very tired, but I need your prayers, and I believe that God will help me to do this work. You can't just start a revival. So one day we had a little girl, she was the naughtiest little thing we had in the place. She stood up and started crying. She says, "I'm a sinner, and I want to be a good girl." It just struck everybody. In 1 minute, the revival broke. The children fell on their faces, they cried, they wept, and that thing went on for weeks. You put the food on the table, they wouldn't even go to the meal. They were under the benches, we had to carry them out. I never can tell you the time I had to stop those children from praying day and night. We couldn't stop them. The Spirit of the Lord fell on those children, and I would never believe it unless you saw it. It went on for weeks. The boys would go to the schools in town, and they'd get out and start preaching in the grounds of the public schools in town. They'd go out in the fields and make prayer meetings. And really, I can never tell you what it was like. They were filled with the Holy Ghost. They sang, they prayed, they spoke in unknown tongues. The power of God fell on that place. There was one evening, I remember, every one of my big boys stood up and testified to salvation. I can't tell you what it was like, folks, but it was wonderful. It went on for weeks and weeks. And we've had quite a revival just before I left. That was among the girls. They prayed on so late until night, we had to stop it because we couldn't let them go on like that. The elders couldn't sleep, the babies couldn't sleep, and the hospital sick people would go in, have prayer meetings in the hospital, and the sick children couldn't stand it. And it was just all over the place. But the power of the Lord can fall among those poor little innocent children that don't know what it's about, but if you could see them with the tears flowing down their cheeks, and crying and praying to God and paying no attention if you're looking at them or didn't look at them. I'd make them get up and they wouldn't even know it, maybe that I was even touching them. They were just out of this world. God fell among the children. One day, I was sort of discouraged and I thought, oh my, I wonder how much good we really are doing. And one of the little girls said, "Mama, I want to preach tonight." Just a little girl like that. Well, she's not that big. She got up and preached the story of salvation so beautifully and so simply. And the way she told the children, you know, she said, "You know, children, Jesus, he knows you make mistakes. Well, we all make mistakes. But he says, 'Never mind, children. Now, you won't do that again, will you? And I'll forgive you. You know, I died for you. I'll forgive you.'" Well, she talked to that kind of talk to those little children until really I was just stunned. Because she just had the plan of salvation so plain that a wayfaring man, though a fool, need not err therein. I'm not going to talk any more to you now because I'm a little bit tired. I'm not very well. I wish you'd pray for me. I have high blood pressure and a number of little things like that. It's not very comfortable when you're not feeling well and traveling all the time. So you pray for me, will you?